I think this idea of him as the sort of autocrat is sort of used as partly emphasising what happened in Russia, and you got these dictatorships there, but that was part of his character, you know, this idea and what he was after. And Butterworth says somewhere about, you know, his aiming to leave the international and things, but of course he was concerned about the particular ideas that he had for the development of the working class movement, and concerned that with the anarchists who were after something. They had some of the, as you sort of said, some of the same ideas about what they might like to see ultimately, but strange ideas about how to get there. Engels said that if you're going to have any sort of organisation, I was just looking for it, I kind of couldn't find it. And he says about if you're running a factory or a ship or something, you've got to have some sort of organisation. Is it even if there are only two people, you've got to have someone, you know, you've got to have some agreement, some organisation there. You've got to have some administration, and because administration shouldn't be confused with government. And we have administration in the Socialist Party, but it isn't a leadership entity. It's not a government. It's purely for administration.
And the common mistake, of course, was that you cannot have any kind of revolution that is thoughtless. It must be based upon clear conception of what is going to happen and what you want to happen.
And because he did talk about there were revolutions happening in the 19th century, where the feudal powers being defeated, and I think somewhere he refers to the revolution going to be next year in the East, and was that those sort of circumstances that he wasn't actually thinking about the socialist revolution happening there. It was after there'd been the war between Turkey and Russia, and the Turks had been defeated, but Marx had already, you know, given a trouncing to the army and the finances, and the Tsar and the leaders of the army or directors of the army had given them a trouncing, and the situation in Russia, and the revolution would be, the next revolution would be in the East. But as I say, I don't think he was talking about a socialist revolution. He was talking about revolution in the context of the kind of things that were happening in the 19th century.
It's very interesting. Today we see the same sort of thing happening, I've mentioned this before, whenever you talk to people and say, oh, well, we've got to tighten our belts because of the state of the economy, without thinking about what causes the state of the economy and what it actually means. Everybody accepts the idea that's handed down in its crude form, and it's a fait accompli.
Yeah. This idea of the state taking over from religion, I've read that, I thought, well, yes, you know, that's exactly it. You know, your loyalty to the state, and it's our country and all that stuff, and really I quite like to see people being happy, but I did feel uncomfortable about all this lining up to cheer, that, you know, people going past with the flame and waving flags and all that stuff, you know, is really you think, oh dear, where are we going here, or how far have we got to go?
That's another area that interests me. The flags, of course, were encouraged by the state and everything, because they're in a hard time. Of course, they wanted to see that good field factor. But the cheering of the athletes itself does not have to be associated with nationalism in any way. Now, I say that as someone who believes that sport should be competitive. I can't see the point of it otherwise, because you're not straining to do your best. And that's like as someone who goes to football matches and cheers on a team. It's not part of nationalism. It's something else. It's a part of your own culture, whatever it is. And you separate that entirely. But of course, what the government did was seize this opportunity to turn it in to what it became.
The bread and circuses.
Yes.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
Could I just say I quite enjoyed the Olympics, actually. Because of quite like the entertainment. What always struck me was interesting was that people would say, "Oh, it makes me proud to be British." But nothing to do with you. You didn't think that were
you. No.
I mean, I can understand people taking pride in their achievement of, you know, playing tennis or whatever, and or even just been picked for the team. I can understand them. But the idea that somehow we have ourselves reflected in their glory, just appalling. And I've said this to one or two people on my acquaintance, and they kind of look at me as if they say, "Oh, but it's still good, you know." I'm really pleased that, you know, that so many people did well, and that, you know, and it was nice. I mean, I like cycling, so I was really pleased when we go. When the Tour de France, great, you know. And the fact that the first time a Brit has done it, well, that's fine, it shares out the glory in a way. It's not my glory, I'm just pleased. You know, I just take an interest in the strategy of running a team and, you know, and working things out over a long period of time. Fascinating, it's just chess, really, it's a kind of chess game.
Well, again, there, you see, that's, again, there's two sides to that. It's true what you say, but there was another group of people who were so pleased and congratulatory because they fondly imagine, alas, they're going to have cold water upon them, that this success will lead to brilliant facilities for sport in schools and everywhere else. And that's where they've got the complete wrong end of the stick, because we know they'll be cut back. At the same time as the government complains about obesity in children, it will be selling off the playing fields.
I think people get a false impression of the Olympics because we were in Italy and they never show you the English athletes at all. Not at all. You've got probably three or four little items during the three-channel system. There's only maybe two or three little bits about Italian athletes. No mention of the English athletes at all. And I think in America, when that was in Coca-Cola race, in the States, what they'd done was they only shoot American athletes if they won.
Yes.
If they didn't win, they never put it on. They were always delayed, they used a delayed system.
That's absolutely true. My daughter was in America a couple of Olympics ago, and she came back, she was amazed. She said, I never saw another athlete, except Americans winning. It was like Hitler in Germany, wasn't it?
Yes.
What was that? It was George. One of the southern states, wasn't it? Was it George?
I don't know.
Yeah. Anyway, it shows you, doesn't it, this...
It's the same.
It's the same that it's a propaganda thing for individual states.
Yeah.
It's a shame they turn every good party into a blasted propaganda exercise. It's incredibly annoying because it gives you ambivalent feelings about enjoying yourself.
Yes.
Don't you think part of the problem we've got is that they've done an awful lot of work on, say, the royal family the last couple of years, and it keeps messing up. And they've done a lot of work on sport, the Olympic Games, and it's because, in a sense, the real religion, while except this, you know, the state, you know, is important, nationalism, building all that, is about individualism. We don't talk about the Iraq war anymore or Afghanistan, we talk about our soldiers, you know, individuals, you know, make it personal. And people are finding it harder to buy as many toys as they'd like, to go as many holidays as they'd like, because the economy is a bit ropey just now. So it's worth a lot of effort for them. You know, and it is one of the things that really came across with the Olympics was, oh, we were in the doldrums, and now we're feeling good.
Yes.
And you thought, yeah, that's right, that's what it's about. Make them feel good.
Mm.
And it's not so much proud to be British, or, well, that's partly it, but it's just about we did well. You know, gosh, we're not really, you know, as kind of down as we as it appeared. And of course, reality will click in very quickly.
And it's such hypocrisy. And one of the things that sickens me in the House of Commons every day, they get up and read the names of the soldiers who died and pay a full tribute. I bet you when Cameron got back there, if I said, what was the name of that soldier you read out this morning? He wouldn't have a bloody clue, would he? He wouldn't have a clue who it was. So it's all part of the same pattern.
What was interesting for me was that the Paralympics were put on almost simultaneously as the government pushed through the welfare reform bill, which was attacking the disabled benefits. And, well, I've read quite a bit about it, and it's the beginnings of the turnaround for the philosophy of the welfare state. I mean, it is a really deep, incisive attack. So that was going through, and I mean, what surprised me was that just like, where was everybody?
They were at the Olympics, or they were watching it.
And that coincided because it started in May, and the welfare reform bill started in March. Are going through the what they do, what is it, like all these procedures. And I mean, it was just pushed to the back of the newspapers and the news, because, you know, I don't think that was pure chance, that was all arranged, because it's one of the biggest reforms for years, an attack, direct attack on the welfare state. And at the beginning of the end of the welfare state, philosophically, of being a safety net for those in need, that's going rapidly. I'm directly affected. My benefits have been cut. And the disabled, there was a disabled demonstration back in when it first started its reading. Good on, you know, where was all the able people when it eventually pushed through? They got the Queen, this week they had the Queen's, what do you call it, the Queen has to sanctify it, doesn't she?
Yes.
I said, they got that, and it's law now. And without a peep from anyone, but there's commentary in the Guardian, and all the papers and stuff. A few arguments on the telly. But, you know,
that's what they do.
Direct attack on the poorest.
And what better time to do it from their point?
Exactly. Well, no, I don't think that's a coincidence. I think that's arranged.
Mm-hmm.
It's so obvious because Cameron is desperate to push it through. Because they had uprisings in the House and people opposing it, but because the attention was on the Olympics, and it was really interesting how it was the disabled Olympics, you know, and they were attacking the disabled benefits. So it's like as if they're saying, you know, well, here we have all the disabled people, and look what they can do. So you lot on benefits can get up and go to work.
Of course. Of course it isn't called the Disabled Olympics, though, is it?
Pardon?
It's not called the Disabled Olympics, either.
No, I know. What's all that about? What's our names? The names?
Para something. What does para mean?
Para. I don't know. What does it mean?
Yeah, probably.
More is the same as or equal to.
Oh, yeah, parallel. It means parallel, whereas people might think it means paraplegic or something. I think it means parallel.
Sure.
Yes, yeah. It goes on alongside the other Olympics.
Oh, right. But, why didn't they call it Olympics for the disabled? Because, you know, we're going to attack the disabled benefits, and then we'll put the Olympics on at the same time. But Yeah, I think that's behind it, to say, look what all these disabled people are doing.
You remember what happened previously when the Conservative government under Thatcher was in and the unemployment figures were going up? They were encouraging people to go onto the disabled register at that time, so that they were trimmed off the figures.
Yeah, see, because that's how they wanted to get the unemployment figures down.
Yeah.
And they did it. And they're still managing to do that. But now, this is going to go the way of... I really do think it's like now that it's maybe a few years, but it'll be you work for your benefit or you don't get any benefit.
Well, it's already so. And you've already got people who are sent to some sort of what they call them job seeking centre, whatever it is.
They have to work for 6 months.
And they have to pay the fare to get there. They then go to a job they're poorer off than they worked for. Mm-hmm. And like everything else, the general public does not know the extent of what is going on. Mm-hmm. And in social housing, which I'm involved, we're trying to get the tenants to take more power. But again, most of them are apathetic, and the changes that are going to be impacting in the next year
are
tremendously deep and will affect everybody right across the country.
Yeah.
And if I hear once more, and I had a teacher, I'd go to a school and help with the little philosophy classroom, infamous, it's lovely, but the teacher's a lovely woman, and she came to see me, introduced her partner to me the other day, and she said, "You must be pleased that Mr. Cameron announced that although they're stopping the building of affordable housing in the private sector, he's going to give millions to build them himself. Apart from the fact they've only built a couple of hundred since they've been in, the whole term affordable housing is nonsense. Affordable in housing in those terms is housing that is above the social housing rate but below the market rate. So in Notting Hill, an affordable house could be £750,000, and an affordable rent would start at, you'd have to earn £78,000 to move in. It's like everything else they do. They've taken the term affordable and completely distorted it into a market term.
Well, I hate it every time I hear the term. I think, well, why would they build houses that they couldn't sell? They're not affordable to anyone.
It's something we're challenging very strongly. The same with the concept of sheltered housing. There's going to be no more built ever. So that's right out of the wall.
On
this point of what people know about is what the papers tell them. It was very interesting last Friday when the big news was that an official commission has decided that the South Yorkshire Police were lying in their teeth and altering police constables' statements. About 160 statements were altered to get an acceptable version of the Hillsborough disaster, i.e. to arrive at the conclusion that the people who were killed were at fault for dying, presumably, the 96 people who died. I had a free read, I often do, at the supermarket of all the papers. I go and have a free read. They'll find me out finally. But I read all the papers, and it's very interesting. Every paper have that as the big news, which was the big news of the day. This is, the South Yorkshire Police and the coroner and the press and MPs and journalists and so on have all been lying all this time. This was really big news. Every paper had it as the main front page story except one. Now, who can tell me which was the one paper which didn't have anything about it on the whole front page?
Star.
It was the Daily Telegraph.
Ha!
The Daily Telegraph had nothing about it on the whole front page. Possibly it had further on, I didn't have the nerve to pick up a telegraph and read it, but it didn't have anything on the front page. Even the Express, which was, of course, pursuing its usual point about the migrants coming here and taking all our jobs and houses, even that had a big thing at the top, across the top, about the Hillsborough disaster. But if you were a Daily Telegraph reader, you wouldn't have thought it was important. In other words, the people who read the Daily Star wouldn't have known particularly about that, because obviously it's not a good story from the point of view of the owners of the Daily Telegraph. So they don't put it in. They don't put it on the front page anyway. Mm. That's just an interesting point.
The whole thing about that whole appalling incident, the thing that most upsets me and staggers me, that no papers actually made this point. It's all about the corruption, how disgusting, how old is that? But the fact that the state was planning to keep 455,000 pages of evidence that was no threat in any conceivable way to state security a secret from the rest of the population. That's what they are. They're no better than, no worse than any of the other not known people.
Yeah.
I wonder what Marx would have made it all.
Yes, this term affordable always amuses me. Affordable to whom? It's always the question. Abramovich or the Duke of Westminster.
But it's got to be affordable to someone, otherwise they wouldn't build it. I mean, it's
it just means it's an economic term for the market, the rate that's not social. But below market. It's an economic definition, that's
what I mean. Well, I mean, we grew up with council housing.
Not affordable to people on minimum wage or welfare.
No, of course not.
No.
Is that affordable to people on what level?
Whatever. If you live in Notting Hill, it's 750,000.
Yeah.
If you live in Cornwall,
yeah. When the council estates were built in Dagenham and Beckentry, the rents were set at a thing so that they weren't for the poorest workers to have them. I mean, that part of the building of them was for soldiers, you know, after the First World War, the houses there, but or ex-soldiers, I should say. But that's the rents were set at a certain level, weren't for the price. The same thing applied, in fact, to the buildings that went on at the end of the 19th century, the Peabody type buildings and things. They also weren't for the poorest.
Already in my housing association, one person has had to pay extra rent because they had a spare room. And it's not their fault. They don't want to do it. Our housing association are completely opposed to it. But the council ordered them, the government ordered them.
Yeah.
And every formula for calculating our rents, people who are in social housing, the rents by government order have to go up every year according to their formula, which is £2 plus 5% of the RPI, when the pensions are given, of course, on the CPI. So you're losing all the way through. People who are worst off are losing all the way through. But that doesn't surprise us, does it?
No.
I think the plan is for the next couple of years to get the government to put down all the heavy measures that can. If we can get away with it, that's great. If not, two straws in the wind, I noticed, last few days. One was the Shadow Chancellor saying that the next Labour government couldn't be expected to reverse the economic measures that the present government is taking. The other one was this morning, the Today programme. They reported Miliband is saying, worse to the effect that Mrs. Thatcher had laid down the economic basis for the prosperity in this country. And the comment was, by the BBC man, he's in danger of making himself electable. And I'm thinking, the Labour Party moving further to the right, there's going to be no danger to capital, but they can come in with a clean sheet. They'll get the present government to do the dirty work, and if the general public are sick to death of them, it will be suddenly The Labour Party will smell of the roses. Bring in the new boys. Let's have some radical reforms. And of course, business as usual.
Of course. And there's the litmus paper test. How many of the Thatcher anti-trade union laws did the new Labour government reverse?
No.
All the selling of the council houses.
Oh, dear.
And where did the money go?
So, you know.
Yes, I said about this, the big myth about Russia and the Russian Revolution being socialist and the harm that had done, but equally was the Labour Party having been known as a socialist party, and that was because the founders, some of them were known as socialists, but it was socialists and some trade unions that formed the Labour Party, which is another, as an aside, an irritation when they sort of there's criticism of the Labour Party in connection with their union paymasters, as it were, when it was the unions that helped to form the Labour Party. But they were known as socialists, and I think probably early members of the Labour Party, probably some of them were socialists. I mean, I could remember an old socialist standard and someone there speaking, that I think it was in Watford, and the Labour man said to the party man, well, we're going the same way as you, but we're going to do this first, you know, and all the things that it was going to do, as I recall, it was to do with housing and all the things that you can think of, but they were going to do that first, but we're going the same way as you. And I remembered an MP saying that when he was new in the party, he was speaking at a meeting, and he was told that, well, if someone asks you a question about education or housing, what you have to say in ringing tones is what we want is a socialist policy. No one knew what it meant, and you know, that's what you had to say. I mean, and he said his view then was that if anyone said socialist, they should say what they meant, you know. But that also, of course, did great harm to the term that they were known as socialist, because now, because they don't like to touch the word with a barge pole, as it were.
But there was a sort of trade union consciousness, I suppose you could call it, that persisted. And, of course, what came out of this was the mistaken belief now that socialism means nationalisation. Mm. That's another leap made in people's minds. Not that I'm entirely that nationalisation did have some good byproducts, especially for the miners, because the mortality rate fell dramatically. But it was a byproduct of what wasn't their intention.
Yeah, that gives me the opportunity to use this quote from Engels. from socialism, utopian and scientific. It says, on the state, but the transformation either into joint stock companies and trusts or into state ownership does not do away with the capitalistic nature of the productive forces. In the joint stock companies and trusts, this is obvious. And the modern state, again, is only the organisation that bourgeois society takes on in order to support the external conditions of the capitalist mode of production against the encroachments as well of the workers as of individual capitalists. The modern state, no matter what its form, is essentially a capitalist machine, the state of the capitalist, the ideal personification of the total national capital. The more it proceeds to the taking over of productive forces, the more does it actually become the national capitalist, the more citizens does it exploit. The workers remain wage workers, proletarians. The capitalist relation is not done away with.
Okay. I think again, along with the Labour Party's obfuscation of what socialism is about, I think public intellectuals play that role as well. I mean, people like George Bernard Shaw or something, aligning himself with the Fabian Society and all this kind of stuff. I mean, you know, and you have that today. People look up to some pop band or punk band or whatever, rather than thinking for themselves.
Yeah.
You know, with a critical analysis of what's
going
on.
Bob Geldof filled that role at the time, didn't he?
That's
a good example.
And this kind of, this feel-good stuff, I mean, you were talking about maybe the state acting as the role of a religion. Well, there are plenty of other things that compensate for people's sort of sense of wanting a community as well. I mean, people are... wanting to brand themselves with a Nike swoosh or something, or look up to the great Apple company, or this kind of stuff. So they're all, you know, all this kind of stuff is going on, and that's, and then TV and celebrity and stuff. So
celebrity,
you know,
yes.
It's all, you know, taking a focus away from their own critical understanding and empowerment.
Mm. Yes.
Yes, of course, the members of the Labour Party, if you talk to them, will claim that they are socialists. And we're going... I remember giving a talk to a Labour ward party and telling them they were all wrong and this is what socialism was. And, you know, giving them the whole half an hour president. And I thought we'd have a good argument. Well, I couldn't get an argument started. Oh, I agree with you. Oh, yeah, this is what we're after. Just before we do that, just this one moment before we do that, we're going to do this other, but we're all going the same way. You know, and after a Labour government, once upon a time, oh, well, you couldn't blame them because the first two Labour governments were minority governments and couldn't do what they wanted to do. But now you've had Labour governments in full power. Mm. And yet here they are, oh, yes, that's the way we're going. Well, it's not enough to be the way we're going. You have to decide if this is what you're going to do now, not after the National Health Service and nationalisation and this or that reform. Mm. This is the whole business which distinguishes socialists from reformists. Mm. We're not saying you could improve it, and there are no doubt ways that you could improve the capitalist system. But as socialists, we want a different system where you don't have the possibility of people making it worse or better. You want a completely different system of society. And that's the beginning and end of it.
Yes, I mean, the big thing is that reforms can be taken away, whittled down, and as I've been saying, it's...
And that's... I'm just going to say, the big attraction for loads of ordinary folk is that it seems to be slow and steady. And when the Fabian model, the kind of tortoise road to socialism, the idea was it was plodding, but it was getting there, and you could always point to things like the welfare state and stuff like that. And it seemed as if things, you know, certainly when I was active in the unions in the 60s and 70s, it looked as if, you know, there was an opportunity for change. There was a certain amount of optimism in the air. But the Labour Party, and I was a member of the Labour Party for quite a long time, a lot of people in the Labour Party that I think are socialists, but considering that would be one particular one who ended up an MP in the first Tory Blair government, had in St Albans, and he had worked for the gas board, and when it was nationalised, he'd refused to take the shares because he was in a job where they were going to dump so many shares on him. He said, "No, I don't want them. Forget it." And so, I mean, he had some principles. But it was always, at last we've got a leader, somebody who's actually going to, you know, have a bit of backbone. And inside the Labour Party, it's always been another sellout, somebody else, another bloody Ramsay MacDonald.
Mm.
And it's difficult because for people in the Labour Party and for their supporters, because they are so... lacking in confidence, and it's everything in our society is short. You know, it's like a history of great men and great women to look up to, celebrities to be worshipped, and to a certain extent, the Olympics plays into that. You know, supermen and women, and to actually persuade people they can do it for themselves. That's a terrible hurdle. And when you talk to them, it's not I couldn't do it and my friends couldn't do it. It's the others. It's the Maddies. You know, it's the ones who never work. It's the one, you know, and all the rest of it. That's a terrible. It is an inferiority complex.
And they've always got a perfect excuse. A true story I tell sometimes at meetings was that when I worked opposite the Labour Party headquarters in Lewisham when Blair came to power, I went across and looked at the new policies. Well, they weren't out, they unprinted them, but I talked to the woman there And I pointed out what the previous Labour administration had done. And she said, but that was then. We've got Tony Blair now.
Oh,
and
God,
I said, well, what does he think? Well, we don't know yet. Well, we're going to find out.
Give him a chance.
Yes. Because most of if you sort of speak to Labour Party people, they never admitted to being in the same Labour Party as the one that formed the government. We don't agree with that. We, you know, it's sort of we belong to the Ben Wing, you know, or something.
And what a great weapon reform is for the state. I mean, reforms, obviously, we welcome some reforms where they enhance the life of anybody who's deprived. But, of course, the trick of reforms and the great trap of reform is that if there is a reform that's halfway decent, then people see that as the end of the struggle.
Yeah.
It becomes the aim instead of something that we needed, just another sop.
And it's often at someone else's expense, you know, sort of this sort of, we're going to increase the benefits of those down there, but they do it by scraping a bit down from those there, you know, down. It's what happens.
I can't wait for next year to see my 5p being deducted from my housing. 25p,
you see.
Mine's gone down £20 a month, and there's no right of appeal now. Now, but because it's a government term, what I don't understand is that. Well, yeah, I know it's from the government, but it's a government. You know, like there's no right of appeal locally to government directive, which a letter was sent out, which was sent out in 2011. Apparently, and they sent it to me, and you know, I don't remember anything about it, but anyway, they've taken away people's right of appeal.
Well, that's the trick they have. What they do now in social housing, like the rent increase, they call it formula. It's a formula. You can't appeal against a formula. You can appeal against certain things, but not against the formula. Everybody in social housing has to have the formula to increase their rent. You can't escape.
It's better to finish while it's going.
The formula is what the government decreed, like the example I gave, £2 plus 5% of RPI every year, the rents must come.
Mind you,
this is a
formula
for
you.
They've now made a formula for calculating benefits. That is the formula. There is no appeal against the formula.
Yeah, and also there's now going to be universal credit. I don't know if you've heard of it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which is going to be whatever. If you're not working and you need a benefit, it's just going to be one universal credit. Which, you know, that's sounding just like what they're going to do there, the formula. So there's no one to talk to, and it's going to. You do it online, and they didn't realise that there's millions of people who don't have a laptop or computer or don't even know how to use one.
They're calling it something else. One of my friends in where I live, he was told to have applied for tax credits. He's now £15 worse off. I warned him. I said, don't apply for them! They tried to get me to apply, and I wouldn't do it because I knew where I was and I knew what would happen. They even resorted to phoning me up instead of sending me letters. But I made it clear I wasn't interested. But they've trapped thousands of people. What's portrayed as a benefit has been a reduction. I've got to go, unfortunately. Is there a collection going on?
Yes, yeah. Treasurer collection.
Because you would then lose that, because if you got tax credit, you'd have to pay more council tax. It's like if you get tax, whatever benefit you get, you've got to pay more. Can I take off another benefit?
I'll give you a ring.
To keep you on a minimum level. You're not allowed to have a level that
everyone got one.
You want. It's got to be this level. So if you apply for tax credit, I'll take off something
else. And don't let them fall you. Council will have to do what they do. And some of them do it really badly, some of them try to do it more sympathetically. I happen to live in an outstandingly good social housing charity, but many of those are rubbish. Many of them do their best, but ultimately the buck stops with the politicians. And their trick is to pass a law saying, well, they don't have to do that, they can do that, but they don't give them the finances to do it. And that's how they get round it. Yeah. They say, look, it's in the law, they can enact this by the council, but they don't give them the finances.
Yeah.
Anyone got to go? Thank you, Pat.
Yeah,
I'll give
you
drinks
there. Yeah, nice. Yeah. Right. But the big job was that the very company which has the job of interviewing all the people on benefits to try and get them off benefits was one of the sponsors of the Paralympics. You know, at the same time.
Yes.
They don't seem to mind, you know, anybody laughing at them. You know, it is so open. Incredible.
Atos, yeah, the company that doesn't give a toss.
They were
sponsoring the Paralympics. Now tell me there isn't a conspiracy going on. Do you know what I mean?
Which isn't actually a conspiracy. I mean, it's just
the way
it works.
Just
yes.
a plan.
Yes, yes.
A plan by those that can.
Yes.
Yeah, so that's what the disciples were demonstrating against outside ATOS offices.
Yes.
Way back in March, I think it was.
Yes.
So they were sponsoring the Paralympics. Yes, Paralympics.
Probably wind up now, I think, unless we'll probably wind up now unless anyone wants to say anything or
no?
Okay, do you want a concluding comment?
Yes, well, the discussion has been quite interesting, and we're still sort of faced with this task of implementing the socialism as Marx envisaged it, which does mean the actual abolition of the capitalist system and instituting instead a system of common ownership, production solely for use, where we make things simply to be used, take a proper account of resources and so on. But that is the aim of socialism, which needs, because it would mean such a transformation of the social system, it needs the majority understanding, and we have to continue to work to get that majority understanding. Whether it takes the form exactly as we suggest would be a good idea for it to go that way or not, we have no control over it, but we have to advocate the political change, the using the ballot box, as it were, as to show that there is the majority, the necessary majority, in favour of making that necessary change to common ownership and production solely for use.
Thank you.